Hey everyone, I'm Alan Schimmel.
And Mitchell Ashley.
And you're listening or watching
DevOps Chats.
Fantastic. Hey Mitchell, I think it took us, what is this, the fourth one that since we restarted the series, and we finally got it right.
That's right. Old habits never die. I guess they do. That's the fourth try.
Well, we just had to get our timing down. And because, you know, when we used to record these, we didn't have Zoom and latency issues. We were sitting next to each other.
That's right. Yes. And, and Chantilly, Virginia, are getting ready to go.
Or wherever we were on the road.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, but that's progress for you. Exactly. Or maybe not. Anyway, Mitchell, we've got a good DevOps chat lined up for this week. We're going to start incorporating something we really wanted to do, which was to kind of leverage this amazing library of interviews that we have from Textron TV, you know, that really take great dives into, you know, subject like DevOps. We look at it six ways from Sunday, right? Into every aspect.
Yeah.
And so I'm excited to do that today. And it's an interview you did.
Yeah, with Ben Potter from Coder. We'll get into that very much so. You know, there are over 6,000 videos on Textron TV now.
That's crazy.
DevOps or Textron TV YouTube channel is just like packed with content.
I think also it's probably 4,000 or more there. We might have purged it at one point, but I think it was 4,000 or something. Mm-hmm. And we'll be adding more to that, including this podcast we're going to start running on the YouTube. Because we wind up playing episodes of the podcast now on the Textron TV daily feed, which then makes its way over to the Textron TV YouTube channel as well. So, you know, this is like trying to look up old Star Trek episodes on where you can see them on streaming TV, and they're on Paramount and Netflix and Pluto TV and all these other stations. Well, I think it's the same way.
I joined a Facebook group that's all about the original Star Trek. And I get all these posts, you know, like, remember this episode? Remember this, the Doom Machine? Remember this? Mm-hmm. Who was this character?
I think I belong to the same chat, to the same group.
That's pretty freaky.
I told you, I recently got a really great, I haven't seen you yet, so I haven't even worn it yet. I may just save it for a while, but it's the Star Trek episode with the alternate universe, Spock with the beard.
Yes, evil Spock, but kind of, still good.
Still, right. He still had the good core. Yeah, I can't. Maybe I'll save that for RSA. I'll wear that one day.
I think so. KubeCon or both. Maybe both.
Yeah. Or maybe KubeCon in Paris. Mitchell, before we jump into Ben Potter interview, though, I thought we'd spend a little time talking about DevOps Next, as we're calling this great report you're starting to frame out right now. But really, the report is just a reflection of the actual marketplace, which is, you know, next month, March 14th, actually, will be the 10th anniversary of DevOps.com. First time we published DevOps.com.
Wow, time flies.
Yeah. And DevOps, you know, DevOps has been around at least 2 years before that, at least maybe three. But it's not the same DevOps. Well, in many ways it is, but in many ways it isn't the same DevOps as it was 12 years ago, right? And why don't you take first crack at this? You know, how do you think DevOps is different, or how do you think it's even the same as it was then?
I still remember you calling me up and say, "Hey, Mitch, there's this thing called DevOps. Do you know anything about this? I've got the domain for this DevOps.com. We're starting this site." And, you know, I was like, "No, I'm not really that up on it. Let me go figure it out." And I went and read Gene's Kim book, his book, and then introduced it to the IT team that I was running back then. But it was really early, and it was kind of hard to figure out exactly what it was. And then people started doing it and kind of learned some of the principles out of the book. And one of my first ahas was, okay, it's not a technology. It's a how. It's how you do software, how you create software. And technology is all in support of that. And it's kind of rethinking that. And of course, having the cloud and elastic resources available to you could change how you do software. Microservices and cloud native came along. So it's interesting. It's kind of like the way Agile was, that it really transformed away from monolithic thinking or waterfall thinking to more sprint and iteration, but doing that in a whole software development process and in pipelines. But it was still very tool-centric in terms of this tool fits in this slice, this tool fits in this slice, and this fits here, and they all have their own ecosystem of plugins, or maybe they integrate, or maybe they don't. So you end up in the tool integration business as an IT team or development team. And today it feels like we're at a different place. I mean, it's not everywhere, and not everyone is doing DevOps at the same level. They're all on their own kind of curve of adoption. Some have been doing it for quite a while, but we've gotten to this place where there are platforms that you can do end-to-end DevOps if that's how your organization kind of thinks about solving this. There are sort of much broader suites. You start out as a CI tool, and now we're a CI/CD, and we're this, this, and that, and with security, and with AI, and with this. So all that to say, the reason why we're doing this DevOps Next report is to try to lay out and help everyone, all of us understand, including me, understanding where we really are in the evolution of DevOps, but more importantly, how that's setting us up, DevOps Next, for the next 3-5+ years, as we introduce more things, more AI, more generative AI, more different kinds of applications, more mobile to the apps that we're doing already on the web, or whatever the next technology or approach driver that comes along, app modernization, whatever it might be, to really recognize that it isn't just a set of discrete disciplines that we're hanging together in a linear process. It is really an ecosystem of capabilities that we can craft into the best way to create software.
I love it. You know, listening to you, Mitchell, I'm reminded of the old commercial line. I think it was Orson Welles, for Gallo Winery or whatever. You can't make wine before it's time. And you know what? You can't make DevOps before it's time either. Can you have a DevOps without Agile? Mm-hmm. Can you have a DevOps without Lean? Mm-hmm. Could you have DevOps without the cloud?
Exactly.
Can you have cloud native without DevOps?
I think that we're pretty sure, no. But yes, yeah. I mean, to your point is, it is, I mean, whether you're going to go back to the manufacturing side or think about how we're using Agile and Lean in software. The other thing that's happened with DevOps, you know well as I do, is it's the ideas behind it. Everybody has said, well, I can do that in my part of the business, right? I can do that in the product group. I can do that in operations. I can do that in my business strategy and planning. You know, this iterative cross-functional teams, all those things we learned in Lean and Agile and brought in with us into DevOps. It was interesting when I think one of the first DevOps enterprise summits I went to, the auditors had a panel. They're all excited about being part of this. They could see how they could play it as part of this whole process. And that was an eye opener. It's like, okay, this has gone far beyond what we thought it might be.
Far beyond just developers and ops.
Exactly.
And I think that's another, so I think that's a big lesson that will probably shine through in the DevOps Next report, which is, as much as everyone wants to focus on tools, it really isn't just the tools. It's the culture of having a cross-functional team, of doing things like a blameless postmortems, of communication, open lines of communications, of trying to automate, go faster, but better. Right, we do it with our software, but we want, we talk about platform engineering. Platform engineering is part of this whole discussion too, right? Why do we do platform engineering? To go faster, to do more
productivity
with less, right? It's the same driver. It's part of the same dynamic of what drives DevOps. And I wouldn't have guessed this 10 years ago, because I think fell into the trap that a lot of other people did, which is, we focus on the tools. We focus on the tools.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what we buy.
Yeah. And that's who pays us here at DevOps.com, right? So we focus on the tools. But I'm really looking forward to see what do we hear about from a cultural perspective on DevOps and how people are taking that undefined, you know, axiom around culture and applying it into real life business situations, not just software development. I think that's a big piece of this.
It's interesting for me because, you know, the gray hairs mean I've been around for a while. I remember the methodology wars, and it's about this is, you have to follow the methodology and which methodology is the best one. And this is the next better one. And yeah, it never sat right with me because every organization operates differently, right? You can't force everybody into one mold and this is the right, because I call them the religious methodology wars. I mean, it really was. It's just like, you know, you're going to heaven, you're not, because you're not following the methodology or whatever. And when Agile came out and really made a lot of sense to me, because I'd already been part of the total quality management training, the iterative improvement and all the different techniques that we learned there, and way of making iterative progress and improving quality, whatever you're working on. And so when we got to a point of working together on DevOps, and you know, you did DevOps.com to kick that off, it just seemed like a lot of things came together at the right time. You know, timing's everything. We know that from
Absolutely. Timing is everything. And I think you're 100% right. You know, I'll tell you, by the time this podcast is available, our newest site, TechStrong ITSM, will be out. And a lot of people may be saying, ITSM, that's not new. I got the AI thing, but why ITSM? Because when we think about the religious wars around process and around, you know, how to do things, for a lot of people, ITIL, I-T-I-L, right? ITIL is the very definition of it. Mm-hmm. But there's much more to ITSM, and even ITIL itself has changed over the years. Yeah. And, you know, my opening story on TechStrong ITSM, my opening post, was that, you know, ITSM is part of this continuum that we have, you know, agile to where agile leaves off, DevOps picks up. Where DevOps leaves off, ITSM picks up. And of course, there's places in there for things like platform engineering and SREs and SLOs and you know, all of the various disciplines that have developed to fill in the gaps here. But it's definitely a continuum. And, you know, I think one of the lessons learned is, again, would DevOps be here if not but for Agile, Lean, and what would be cloud and blah, blah, blah? Had ITIL not been what it was, would DevOps have evolved differently? Absolutely. Oh, yeah. And had DevOps not evolved, would ITIL still be what it was then instead of what it is now and what it's morphing into?
That's a perfect example. I remember interviewing a couple of folks from Axios that wrote updated ITIL to ITIL 4, I believe it is. And really
going Axelos. It was Axelos.
Axelos, thank you very much.
Right.
And they were and I didn't realize it, but they had gone back in that iteration and said, yeah, we kind of went down the process for process sake. That's my interpretation and prior. It just got a little too dogmatic, again, my words. But they went back and said, how do we incorporate this stuff from Agile and DevOps? And they did a yeoman's, yo person's job of trying to really open it up and make it more flexible and adaptable. And I'm sure that process continued, but I think that at least one of the reasons why, you know, ITIL and ITSM, you know, both are still widely adopted. You know, they didn't just kind of go by the wayside and something else replaced it. They're still a huge part of
it. But and they're still evolving, as is DevOps. Mitchell, we could talk about this all day, but we're never going to get to your Ben Potter interview. Why don't you set the table for that one?
I'd love to. A few weeks ago, I got to speak with Ben Potter. He's head of product at a company called Coder. And I've long been interested in how the development environment is changing for software creators and, you know, how far IDEs have come and cloud development and developing at a Starbucks or in the plane, on the plane. And one of the things that what Coder does is provide cloud development environments, right? So you can quickly stand up or utilize in an environment. And if you're starting out in software, it doesn't sound like that big of a deal. Maybe it saves you some steps, right? Or if you're starting out on a new project, you know, it's a saver, an aid. When you're working in an organization where you might be supporting five or six applications, or even two or three, there might be half a dozen environments or more for each one of those applications. Here's this version with this database that we're supporting for these customers. Here's the second iteration of that. And you've got to have environments to go to be able to write code, test code, deploy it for each one of those iterations. And it gets really complex, really fast. And as I was talking with Ben about, you know, so I don't do this every day anymore. And it's for me to get, you know, okay, what do I need to update to get this in sync with what's out there for that, even for our environments? You know, it's a cognitive overload. And I'm not doing it full time every day across a lot of complex environments. And so it's a real productivity boost when you can turn it on and have that environment. And so it was pretty fascinating talking with Ben, because he talks about AI and some of the new things that are happening. I think folks will really enjoy listening to Ben. So any thoughts? Absolutely. Take a look at the video or listen
and
to
it. I know Coder is going to be with us at KubeCon in Paris. So I'm looking forward to catching up with them in person there. But let's roll. Let's go to the video from a recent TechShrunk TV interview, and we'll be back right after.
Well, hey, everybody. I have a great pleasure of being joined by Ben Potter. Ben is head of product with Coder. Welcome, Ben.
Mitch, happy to be here.
Excellent. I'm glad to have you on. Talking about great things, you know, and this has come up a couple times for me recently chatting. And when I was at KubeCon, I think in Chicago, and talking about cloud development environments. Matter of fact, even a friend of mine on an AI project and I were talking about that. So I'm really intrigued to chat with you. Let's just set some context for folks. You know, if you don't know what a cloud development environment, hopefully the name describes it well enough, but is there any more you should know when we're talking about what is a cloud development environment?
Yeah, the very basics are we're trying to replace developer laptops, meaning developers will always need a laptop or a desktop, but so many applications and are moving to the cloud, yet developers still have to run these applications, whether it's one service, 10 services, or even dozens of services, all on their local machine or some hybrid where they're running some on their local machine, some on the cloud. And as these environments get more complex, especially in large like enterprise organizations, it becomes unrealistic to be able to run these on the local machine, especially when a developer is essentially forced to use a lockdown Windows machine. So what we see happening is developers are creating virtual machines. They're running their code there. That also has a drift from the place they're deploying it. So what a cloud development environment tries to do is give developers a very identical environment to that of which they're deploying that they can test and develop against using their favorite editors, whether that's VS Code or JetBrains. So sometimes when people think cloud developer environments, they think of a browser editor with limited tools and limited keyboard shortcuts. That's not the case. Developers can keep using their editors, but really they have an environment they're developing against that's very similar to where they'd be deploying. So that's kind of the main concept, or at least that's how we define it at Coder.
Great. And then do you actually, well, you know, in IDE tools, like if you're using Visual Studio or whatever your favorite Python or whatever IDE is, some of those have integrated with it, like Homebrew for your Apple, right? To be able to do package management and update and set environments in different contexts. I have to be honest with you, at least for me, I don't do it every day, but when I do it, it's kind of complex to go back and remember. Now, how do I set that? Where's that? Do I need to upgrade this? Is that set up with my environment where I'm pushing this to? It's, you know, it taxes me, and I'm not doing hard stuff either.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We have users who have to follow maybe 30 to 45 steps to get their environment set up. Oh, and those steps are oftentimes very specific to an operating system or a version of an operating system where if someone upgrades to an M1 Mac, for example, and they were previously on the Intel ones, it's a whole new set of steps and that hasn't been updated. So what a lot of our users do is they automate away all those steps so a developer can just click a button and using these powerful cloud technologies such as Docker and virtual machines or even Kubernetes, developers can get these reproducible environments with all their tools set up. So essentially it turns those 30 steps into one. I mean, someone has to automate it and create those images, but it's kind of a one-to-many relationship where you kind of have the confidence that everyone on the team can use those same tools.
Cool. So what's the developer experience like? Are they using an IDE that's running locally on their environments connecting to a cloud development environment? Are they using an IDE in the cloud? How does that work?
Yeah. That's a really good question. And there's two paths that we can support. So the modern editors, which VS Code and JetBrains are the two main ones, have support for running them locally on your machine, meaning you can have your theme, your keyboard shortcuts, your layout, but then you're connecting over essentially SSH into these remote servers where the file system and the terminal is. So all the tools are pre-installed on the remote server, but then it's kind of this like thin client server model. The other option is entirely through the web browser, which is pretty magical. Both Microsoft as well as us at Coder have a version of VS Code that runs entirely in the web browser. And in that case, the full IDE is running remotely, and a developer could connect with even an iPad or a Chromebook and do the development that way. So that one's there are some limitations. You don't get all your shortcuts, but if you're kind of quickly switching between services, it's a great workflow.
I could see that, especially like, hey, Ben's on vacation. I've got to step in and yeah, I kind of know that environment, but I'd sure like a turnkey, browser key. I'm in and I don't have to worry about, you know, making sure my IDE will connect to it. And okay, you know, where's the cert or credentials, et cetera, to get to that. And then how do I move around?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's great for those kind of times that you only need to go into environment maybe once a month. It's maybe a service that you don't always maintain, or like you said, like maybe I'm on vacation and I only have my iPad and I need to hop on and do something. You can kind of have the ease of mind that it's all there and working.
Mm-hmm. And we talk a lot about, I'm trying to remember the term, but the cognitive load, that's the word, that we put on developers. We do that in all kinds of jobs, but we especially put it on developers of there's cognitive load of building your environment, and there's cognitive load of like doing your job, and then there's everything else too. And that context switch across all of those is maddening. I mean, that's where you lose your productivity. You know, I think of software akin to writing a book. You're not going to write a book a sentence at a time. You're going to sit down and write a chapter or write part of one or this part of the story or whatever. And you got to stay there a while, right? You can't deal with interruptions. Why developers wear noiseless headphones all the time if they aren't working from home. You know, how does a cloud environment help you with cognitive load and context switching?
Yeah, our tagline actually is keep developers in flow. And we use that both internally. So how can we make sure that when we're meeting with the development team, it's only in certain times and we can reduce meetings, and also externally in the products that we build. One of the main ways that we help with that is there's this huge expectation from like the DevOps kind of paradigm for developers to start building their applications with best practices in mind, whether that's where they download their packages from or how often they scan or what kind of languages and libraries they use. And with Coder, you can essentially create these recipes for developers to get into an environment that has all of those things installed for them. So if a developer goes to install a package, they don't even need to configure or run security scans. You can have confidence that they're downloading it from a trusted source, wherever those artifacts are and wherever you're scanning it from. We're also seeing that with AI and LLM tools. We have a lot of our enterprise customers pre-installing these tools in for the developer so that it can kind of handle these operations that normally it's pretty difficult to enforce or even like encourage developers to use these best practices. But by having them by default in their editor where they spend the majority of their time, they don't have to spend a lot of time switching out of your editor and doing other stuff. I think there's like a pretty famous quote that like it takes 15 minutes to like a context switcher to fully get back into flow. Mm-hmm. So as much as possible, having these best practices pre-installed inside your editor, as opposed to having to go out and read some wiki to get things set up the right way, the better. So we're essentially trying to only really let developers focus on like what they need to, which is like the libraries and the code, and then the rest can kind of take care of itself through automation.
Mm-hmm. I like to say the best way or fast way to get something done is not to have to do it at all, right? But just let it be done for you, right? If you can. Well, let's talk about the AI side of this, because one of the questions I have is about a cloud development environment is, you know, not all the resources can be put in the cloud or into your environment, right? I have databases, I have APIs that I'm testing with, to third-party services, my own applications, you know, a plethora of things that, you know, there is no application is an island, right? It's all connecting to everything. How do you deal with that? Deal with when you need to talk to other services, or maybe in your LLM, your training data, and you need to keep that updated with the latest that you're using or that's coming, you know, getting ready to get pushed to production. How do you deal with the external things that aren't in your cloud environment?
Yeah. So we have a kind of policy the way we deliver our software that we only want it to be self-hosted, meaning we give the software to our customers and they install it in their AWS or on-prem environments. That's because we have a lot of secure regulated customers who mm-hmm. very, really much value owning their network. So that gives them control over which endpoints and network things they want to expose. So one argument or one example I had earlier was ensuring that artifacts only get downloaded from a secure artifact store, as opposed to the public registries such as Docker Hub or NPM. Where there's so many vulnerabilities there.
It's all good. It's all secure. Don't worry.
Exactly. And on the AI side, we do have even some of the most like regulated customers using AI with Coder, but they have control over those network firewalls, whether they have an on-prem model that they're using or something exposed through ChatGPT. They expose only the aspects that they want. What's super interesting about AI to me is that even the customers that really value security are accepting the risk to use these AI models because of the productivity benefits that they have. And at Coder, you can kind of, we use it because it's self-hosted, you have control over the full network that it's deployed on. Another use case we've seen is it's pretty difficult to get developers access to GPUs. There's a way for developers to like schedule, if you're doing AI development, maybe to schedule out to a build farm. And another use case that we've seen for people who are doing very advanced AI development is they want a full GPU workspace in the cloud, or even multiple workspaces. So we have templates at Coder that let developers get a workspace with a GPU attached. So if they're training a model or working against a local LLM that isn't like training based on your company data, that they have the horsepower to do so in their cloud.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. How about data protection, right? Test data. Right? You need to test with realistic data. Sometimes it's, you know, data you don't want to escape, right? You don't want that data leaked. How do you protect assets like that? Sounds like what you just described would help with that if you're running it within your own, you know, you're in your own environments with your own security controls.
Yeah, that's a really good question. The way that we're seeing our users doing this now is they're deploying a database with either customer data or mock customer data inside the same network that they have Coder deployed in, meaning that a developer doesn't have to open a firewall on their local machine to access it. They're only mm-hmm. connecting it to it through their cloud IDE. So this cloud IDE is on the same network as the customer data or test data or mock data, and multiple developers are able to develop against it. So they're not downloaded onto each CDE. They're not downloaded onto each local laptop, which is a huge security risk. It's all staying within the boundaries of your network. And it can even stay within the boundaries of a web browser, which then can be secured to make sure people aren't copy and pasting out of it and doing things like that. So the real benefit there is because you can put Coder in your own network where the data is, it can never it never has to leave that network. It can all just stay in the web browser or on that environment.
So kind of last question, I could talk to you for another 2 hours, but last question is, you know, right tool for the right job, right? What are things that aren't a great, you know, fit for trying to use a cloud development environment? So don't go down that path. That's not the best way to do it.
Yeah. Anything that's super latency sensitive. So mm-hmm. web development is a perfect example of what's great. You can develop against a modern editor such as VS Code. You can preview your changes in the web browser. That's great. If you're developing a video game, you'll run into some issues because the game is compiling and developing and essentially being sent back. So you can get a full desktop environment through Coder, but it's pretty slow and it's not ideal. I'd much rather do game development on my local laptop. Mm-hmm. Another one that comes to mind is iOS development. Again, this is one of those things where technically it could be done. We created our product to run on Mac hardware, but there isn't a great solution for provisioning Mac hardware for iOS development. There are some solutions out there that I'm closely looking at because I'm interested. But if you're doing any form of kind of app or game or even desktop development, it's not ideal. Again, it can be done if you have some of those pain points, such as like data security, but web development using Visual Studio Code, as well as like JetBrains, is really the sweet spot that we're seeing now. What I think some people think when they hear CDE is that if you have a large complex service, it's actually not a good fit for a CDE. And we're actually seeing the opposite, which is the more complex the service you have, the more you benefit from automating those steps mm-hmm. away and giving it to a developer. Mm-hmm. And I think something else is if people think maybe if they're later or earlier on in their cloud native journey, that it's not a good time for CDEs until they're fully onto the cloud. And the opposite is also true. We have some of our largest customers are using CDEs to get more developers to develop applications for the cloud with those practices. So those are kind of two things that you might think wouldn't be a good fit, but would. But yeah, the game development is not great. I tried it. It's not fun.
Yeah, it's always those edge cases or unique cases. And, you know, you mentioned Mac and Xcode isn't really happy to run itself in other environments. I'm sure that's a bit of a challenge. Well, where can folks kick the tires? You know, anybody that's a developer, technical person, we like to, you know, let us turn us loose. Let us check it out, kind of see how it works.
Yeah, our website is coder.com and our GitHub is also Coder. So it's pretty easy to remember. On the website, you can get a trial to try the enterprise features, but the core product itself is actually open source. So if you're a developer and want this either for your home setup or maybe a small team, entirely free. And then we have that enterprise trial on coder.com as well.
Okay, excellent. Well, Ben, it's been fascinating talking with you. I'm definitely headed there. I'm going to go check it out. So coder.com, right? Is it .com?
That's right. Yeah, coder.com.
Excellent. You always get asked these days because sometimes it's not. I hope you'll come back again. It's been fascinating talking with you, Ben Potter, head of product with Coder. Thanks, man.
Yeah, this is great. Thank you.
Mitchell, that was a great interview. Did a nice job there with Ben. And good for them. I like what Coder's doing.
It is. And Ben was fantastic to talk to because he's working with so many different customers and he's got all these experiences and use cases and as well as heading up product. He's not just a product, you know, here's the roadmap and here's where we're going. He's really out there pressing the flesh and rubbing elbows with developers and figuring out what they need. So I think that's what made it such a compelling interview and discussion with him.
Yep. Many thanks to Ben and the Coder folks. Mitch, I think we're probably a little over time because of the interview and everything, but this was a great DevOps chat. We'll be back next week with another one.
Sounds good. Same place, same bat station, bat channel, right?
Yeah, wherever you're listening to this, keep that dial where it is. For TechStrong and DevOps Chat, this is Alan Schimmel.
And Mitchell Ashley.
Take care.
We'll see you soon.